And I really have not much to disclose of interest to you. So I'm going to tell you about the new sampling methods we deployed to conduct the recent study of mortality in Iraq and compare it to some previous methods used and talk about why our approach might be a new way of going about doing this. So we believe it's important, first of all, to measure wartime mortality, which is an assumption going into this study. There are those who might disagree. And to date, there have been three ways of doing this. First of all, in an ideal setting, countries would have concurrent, ongoing ways of maintaining real live reporting through regular censuses, civil registration of death events, that sort of thing. As you might imagine, in a wartime situation, that's not very likely and wasn't in Iraq. The second method has been to have researchers on the ground try to do population-based representative surveys. So they will survey what we think is a representative sampling of the population, establish a rate, and then multiply those rates times the full population. Again, that would be derived ideally from a recent census. And the third method has been to do sort of passive surveillance of secondary methods. And the most prominent one of these in Iraq has been the Iraq body count, which basically clips newspaper clippings and decides how many deaths there have been by those that have been reported in the press. There's a good paper in 2008 by Tapp et al., which listed all the Iraq mortality studies that have been conducted, compares and contrasts them, and notes that the mortality counts have varied between 50 and more than 700 deaths per day attributable to the war, although these were all conducted at different times and in different ways and by different people, so they're not really very comparable. Our group comprised the 2011 Collaborative University Mortality Study. It was a four-university group that attempted to measure the mortality in Iraq about mid-2011. And I'm not going to talk about the results of that. I'm going to talk about the methods we used. Okay. So the fastest, cheapest, and safest way to conduct population-based mortality studies in war settings is to conduct a household survey using generally a two-stage cluster sampling approach. And cluster sampling attempts to select households or individuals that can represent the study population so that you can take the rates that you derive from your sample and apply them to the full population. Cluster sampling was popularized in the 1970s by the World Health Organization, which used it to estimate vaccine coverage. Everyone remembers the EPI program, the expanded program on immunization. And its methods were sort of popularized and became known as the spin the pen method. Anybody remember this way of referring to it? Because you would drop a pen to decide what your start household would be in your cluster selection, because the pen would point to the closest house. And in that approach, there were typically 30 clusters and 7 households in each cluster. So that was the original origin of the two-stage cluster method. But there have been several criticisms of cluster sampling, especially around the biases that it can provoke. So over time, we have tried to perfect the two-stage cluster method. And most of the perfections have attempted to occur in the second stage. So instead of spinning the pen, you might do something else to more randomly or in a less biased way choose your start household. Another criticism has been that often methods, and this was a criticism of Iraqi mortality studies, often methods tended to choose households that were on more busy streets, and that those households might be expected to be more exposed to violence through the car bombings and things like that. So And any method, of course, that allows the surveyor or the interviewer to choose the household is likely to be biased because they're going to choose households that look more welcoming, right? Okay, so the calls for innovation have been that there might be more systematic ways of randomly choosing both the first and the second stage of your cluster selection. We looked around for a new approach. Two ideas that were suggested in the literature, although never really fully employed, were satellite imagery and use of a GPS. One example of satellite imagery was a study in Niger doing a meningitis vaccination coverage survey. And using GPS, you might randomly select longitude and latitude numbers. That's a numerical system where you could do a random selection. So ideally, studies of this nature would be done in countries with robust and recent census data, which could be used as a sampling frame to randomly select individuals or households for inclusion in a survey. Unfortunately, Iraq's most recent full census was in the 1980s. There was a partial census in 1997, so we're sort of out of luck there. And also, ideally, there would be a safe and secure world in which to approach sampling subjects and ask for their participation. But if that were the case, we wouldn't be needing to do this survey. So we set out to do an innovative approach, and our approach was described in this paper that was published last year in, or maybe earlier this year, in the International Journal of Health Geographics. The tools we employed included a gridded population data set, and I'll talk about what that is, a geographic information software, and Google Earth, which anyone can download for free. A gridded population data set is a global geo-referenced grid cell-based population data set where data are available at a sub-national gridded resolution level. So it's this weird sort of thing that you buy, and it has population data loaded in it at a level below the national level for sure. And in our case, at the governorate level and even more locally than that, okay? And the commercial products available are LandScan, Gridded Population of the World, or the Global Rural Urban Mapping Project. There's also an Asian population data set and an African one, AfriPop and AsiaPop. So we chose LandScan. If you're selecting one of the available options, you'll want to explore what would work best for your population. One major limitation of LandScan is that it's very opaque about how much population is located where. You can't really go in and see, do you agree with how they distributed the population? They would not explain why this is so opaque. We think it's because they get data from Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and that one of the conditions of doing that is that they couldn't release these. So we used ArcGIS as our software product. It's commonly available to researchers at universities, although relatively expensive to ordinary mortals. And GIS is a system of hardware and software used for storage, retrieval, mapping, and analysis of geographic data. And then we used Google Earth. How many of you have Google Earth on your computer? Yeah, so you're all very familiar with this. And it's interactive. It's a virtual globing, mapping, geographical information tool. It's free, functional, and intersects with ArcGIS. It has some limitations. So in rural areas, you don't really see very much. We excluded extremely rural areas from our sampling, partly because Iraq is not an evenly distributed population, and it would be impossible to go to rural areas in the desert. And I would say overall, the images we found for Iraq were really remarkably good. There were a few maps we had to buy from another source, but for the most part, Google Earth was quite good. In the first stage of sampling, we used the 2008 LandScan gridded population data set and ArcGIS to randomly select a sample of clusters weighted by estimated population size. So what we did was created this probability surface, and then we used this tool in the software called Create Spatially Balanced Points, and we generated 125 points across Iraq, which if you zoomed in, you could see what those were. And this map shows the distribution of them, and it's approximate. And because Iraq is not on the equator, the squares aren't quite square because the Earth is round. So these are 30 arc seconds, and it's approximately 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer areas. So basically, we took the map, we dropped a grid down, we randomly selected our clusters that way, and so we ended up with a set of 100. What we wanted was 100. We picked some extras in case we ended up with some that were no good. So we ended up with these 1 kilometer square clusters. At the next level, we had to choose a start house. So you have a 1 kilometer square area on your Google map, and then where do you start there? So we dropped another grid, and this one was a much finer grid, approximately 10 meters square. And And so at this point, you could see the pin that gets dropped there, and you choose the largest roof within this 10-kilometer square area. Let me show you a picture of that. And then that's your start household. It was then up to our surveyors to find this household. And we actually traveled to northern Iraq and worked with them to find the start households that we had chosen in that area, and found it was remarkably easy to do. Because you can see the maps have landmarks in them. There were freeways or water towers or a stadium or whatever, and you can sort of work your way. And one of the people on our team was remarkably intrepid and very interested in finding the start household. It was a bit like a treasure hunt. And we had a very careful set of instructions about how to move from the start household to the next 19 adjacent households. So we did 20 households in each cluster. And we created several maps for each cluster and had a week-long training program for the surveyors, and they completed their work last spring. I would say we learned a lot of lessons, but we do recommend this method, and if you're interested in more details, you should go find that paper. Okay, thank you very much. Can I ask my fellow panelists to come up?